This is Passing Judgment, a podcast about the law and how it affects you. I'm your host, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Think of me as your personal law professor as we navigate the big legal questions of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers. Hey, everybody, it's Jessica, and today I'm going to do an episode just with me, and I'm going to recap some legal and legal/political news that's been happening lately. So first, I am recording this episode on the 100th day of the second Trump administration, and I think essentially everyone can agree that this administration has made big changes to our system of government. And some people love them, some people hate them, but there's no question in my mind that we've never seen a president embrace executive power with this sort of vigor before. We've never seen a president have as broad a view of executive authority. And we have just seen more executive actions than I think we frankly ever have in modern history. So what does the public think of this? Well, we have three new polls that came out just in the last day or so regarding President Trump's approval ratings. And largely, it's not good news for the current president. His approval ratings are hovering around kind of 39 to 43%. Obviously, this means the disapproval ratings are higher than the approval ratings. But one cautionary note here is that I'm not sure that for this president, approval ratings matter as much as maybe for other presidents, in the sense that I don't think he's driven by whether or not in any particular moment the public approves of his job. I think there are a number of things that motivate him. So at this point, all we really know is at the end of April, the people who respond to these polls fairly overwhelmingly disapprove of the job that President Trump has done. I don't think we can read too much into this to say, and therefore we know exactly what's going to happen in the midterms, or and therefore the president is going to change his strategy. I think really all we can say right now is that the people who responded to these polls are not particularly happy with what the president has done so far. Now, I've been asked about this a bit recently, and I'll say a couple more things. One is that I think his base, which is maybe about 33 to 35% of people who respond to polls, will not abandon him, period, full stop. And so what we see is there's about 10 to 7% of people, in addition to his very strong base, that agree with and support the president and the job that he's done. The other is that this president campaigned in a much bigger and bolder way than, frankly, we've seen in the past. And he promised things, in my view, kind of short of miracles. I will stop this war. I will turn the country around. I will immediately make your life better. I will make goods and services that you have to pay for and consume every day cheaper. And it's very difficult to follow through on those promises. And I think what we're seeing from the polling is that people feel that largely he has not. And again, the bigger the promise, the riskier it is to try and actually implement those promises. So I think we're seeing a little bit of an expectation issue as well. We've also heard just anecdotally on the news and in reporting from Trump voters that while they wanted there to be changes, that they maybe didn't expect the extent of these changes or these particular changes. So let's dive a little bit deeper into the polling numbers. As I said, the current approval ratings we're seeing around 39 to 42%, with disapproval ratings ranging from about 53 to 59%. And what are the key issues here? I would say the key issues are the same issues that the president ran on, really, the economy, and in specifically when it comes to the polling numbers, I think the tariffs are a big deal here. And so what we see is I think the administration's recent tariff increases have made people feel a bit uncomfortable. We know that when it comes to the economy, generally stability and predictability is better, all things being equal. So when it comes to the tariffs, I think what we see is a lot of Americans disapproving of these large tariffs because of the possibility that they're going to be paying more for goods and services. In one poll, only 11% of respondents in a YouGov poll felt better off economically since Trump's reelection, while in that poll, 51% felt that the economy was deteriorating. What else can we look to beyond tariffs and economic concerns? I think if you look at the way that President Trump has restructured the government, and specifically the very aggressive cuts to federal agencies, what we have in some data, it indicates that 55% disapprove of these actions. In addition, when it comes to immigration, this is probably the strongest area for President Trump. Some polls indicate that there's 50% approval for his actions with respect to immigration. This is certainly another area that he aggressively campaigned on. Let's look at demographics for a minute. What we have with respect to young voters is that support among young men, what do we mean by young men, about ages 18 to 29 has decreased, whereas when it comes to independent voters, who were obviously crucial to the recent presidential election, they are also increasingly disapproving of the president's job. One poll indicating that only 29% of independents approve of the president's job performance. So again, what does this mean? I would say this is a president that has broken the mold in so many ways. And again, I don't think that a slew of public polls that indicate that approval ratings are at, I've heard, 80 to 100 year historic lows. I don't know that that will significantly change the White House's strategy in this case. So that's what I wanted to talk about with respect to the polls. Now I want to really change gears and talk about another branch of government, the Supreme Court. And that's because typically this is the last week of oral arguments in a Supreme Court term. And there are two big cases, one that's already been argued this week, one that is about to be argued, that deal broadly with the education context. And this term actually will be extended when it comes to oral arguments because on May 15th, the court will hear arguments about the legality of nationwide injunctions. And we're going to devote a whole episode to that. That is an area where I don't want to just kind of skim past it. So for right now, what I want to do is talk about the cases that the court is hearing or heard this week. And as I said, two big cases broadly dealing with education. The first one deals with how hard it will be for people to prove discrimination claims in the education context and maybe beyond the education context. And I'll explain what I mean by that. And the other case deals with the religion clauses and whether or not we will allow the first ever in the nation religious charter school. So let's take the case that was argued this morning first. I'm recording this episode Monday, April 28th. So the first case, in this case, we have a plaintiff and her parents. Plaintiff is a teenager with a rare form of epilepsy, and she requires assistance with everyday tasks at school. Now, in her original school in Kentucky, they shifted her schedule so that she could obtain the minimum number of instruction hours. Her family then relocated to Minnesota, and the district did not accommodate her schedule in the same way. So she and her parents sued under a number of different statutes, but one was the American with Disabilities Act, which requires that reasonable accommodations be given to people with protected disabilities. So the plaintiff and her parents sued in federal district court, and they won and they lost. And so what happened is the district court said the plaintiffs won under one federal law, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, but that they were blocked from getting compensatory damages and a permanent injunction to set her hours of instruction under two different federal laws, the ADA, the Americans with Disability Act, and the Rehabilitation Act. And that's because some courts in our country require a higher standard for discrimination suits related to education under those two statutes, the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Rehabilitation Act. And so what happened is the case was then appealed and the Eighth Circuit agreed with the district court and said, under those two other federal statutes, the plaintiffs would have to show either bad faith or gross misjudgment for suits involving educational services for children with disabilities. And that's instead of a lower standard that plaintiffs typically need to show, which is deliberate indifference or negligence. So I think this brings up the point of how are those standards really different? Well, again, in most cases outside of the education context, deliberate indifference is the standard. And that means that plaintiffs have to show that defendant knew of and disregarded a substantial risk to plaintiff's rights or well-being. But when it comes to bad faith or gross misjudgment, that really requires that plaintiffs prove something more, that defendants acted either with bad intent, that's bad faith, or made a decision that's so extreme, so outside accepted professional judgment, that it amounts to gross misjudgment. So that's why those two different standards really make a difference, because it's much easier to satisfy the deliberate indifference standard. Now, oral arguments in this case this morning got really heated in a way that is not typical. And that's because the plaintiffs in this case accused the school district of changing its litigation strategy and actually making a much, much broader argument here. And essentially, the argument was that the school district was saying that in all discrimination cases, not just in the education context, but in other contexts as well, that higher standard of bad faith or gross misjudgment should be used. This created, frankly, I think, fireworks in the Supreme Court, where you had a good deal of personal attacks between the attorneys and the justices saying to the attorney for the school district, basically, stop using this type of language. Don't call the other lawyers liars. And it got quite heated. Now, where do we think this leaves us in terms of what do we expect from the court? I think the court was uncomfortable with what the school district was arguing. I think there's a decent chance that the Supreme Court sides with the plaintiffs in this case and that they say just one standard should apply and that they don't want this two-tiered standard where you have bad faith slash gross misjudgment in some cases, but deliberate indifference in others. So we'll have to wait for a ruling in June on that case. Now, let's get to the final case I'm going to talk about today, which has not yet been argued before the court, but is one of the bigger cases this term. And this deals with an Oklahoma case involving a Catholic online school that wants to be a charter school. And there is a big question as to whether or not a religious school can be a charter school. Now, what happened in this case in the lower courts? Well, the Oklahoma Supreme Court said that you cannot do this. You cannot establish a religious charter school. And the state Supreme Court said that faith obviously would be part of the curriculum, that this is obviously a religious school, and that that would violate Oklahoma statutes, the Oklahoma Constitution, and the U.S. Constitution. And specifically, what part of the U.S. Constitution? The Establishment Clause that says the government should not establish an official government religion. Now, the school in this case is arguing that it violates a different constitutional clause. It's still a religion clause, still in the First Amendment, if they can't establish this school. And what they're arguing is that it would violate their free exercise clause rights if they're not allowed to establish this Catholic school as a charter school. So what is the Supreme Court going to be looking to on Wednesday? Well, If charter schools are considered to be private operators, then establishing a religious charter school is probably constitutional. But on the other hand, if charter schools are considered to be part of the public school system, then the establishment of religious charter schools would likely violate the Constitution, because I think it would likely violate the Establishment Clause. So if the court were to side with the Catholic school in this case, you know, what would that mean more broadly? Well, it could force states to allow religious groups to create and operate charter schools that explicitly teach religious doctrine. This would be, I think it's worth emphasizing, a pretty significant shift in the Supreme Court's Establishment Clause cases. That for decades, the Establishment Clause has barred the government from funding directly religious instruction. Now, we should note that since about 2017, I think the court has been very protective of people and groups who come to the court saying that their free exercise clause rights have been hampered. And some of the liberal justices have argued that that's been at the detriment of the Establishment Clause, that essentially, if you look at the First Amendment and you look at the two religion clauses, that the court is much more protective of the Free Exercise Clause, not as protective of the Establishment Clause. So I think we really have to look at this case, a potential landmark ruling, to see what is going to happen in terms of, will the court embrace what I would view as a major shift of their religion cases if they allow a religious charter school to exist, again, because the government would be directly funding religious instruction. So I hope that helps you understand those two cases. Again, one has been argued, one has not. I'm glad we could spend some time going over the polling, and we will be back next week with more legal news. As always, please rate, review, and subscribe.